Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today I'll be joined on the show by Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, and Senior Vice President at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, Mark Goldwine. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The Trump administration is keeping the budget process exciting, recently ordering the hold of $250 million in military aid to the Ukraine and diverting $271 million for more immigration detention beds. This on the heels of considering canceling about $4 billion in foreign aid through rescissions. The White House abandoned that effort, however. The $250 million Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative includes $50 million for weapons in an attempt by Congress to shore up the Ukrainian government after Russia's annexation of Crimea in 2014. Congressional leaders are getting riled up by such moves by the administration, further muddying the waters of the 2020 appropriations process. Even after a recess and an overarching budget deal, it appears we're still looking at yet another contentious end to the process. In fact, diverting funds within the Department of Homeland Security for more detention beds and court facilities has drawn bipartisan ire, because even as a large hurricane approaches the southeast, the plan would divert $155 million from FEMA. As has become a common complaint, members of Congress question whether the administration has the legal authority to make such moves, especially in light of language within the fiscal year 2019 spending package that limits the reprogramming of such funds to specific circumstances. A congressional report has revealed that the National Institute of Health needs significant funding to remedy deteriorating conditions at many of its facilities. The report recommends spending $1.3 billion over several years to fix buildings. NIH often enjoys bipartisan support, seeing several years of annual increases in the agency's budget, bringing its total budget to just over $39 billion this fiscal year. Most of the money has gone to medical research, not maintenance. A vast majority of its buildings are more than 20 years old. The already confounding budget deficit projections could become even more astounding, according to the Congressional Budget Office. In CBO's recent report on alternative scenarios, which reflect likely policy and not existing law, such changes in policy could add $2.5 trillion in deficits over the next decade, on top of the more than $12 trillion already cooked into existing law. The Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, which is part of the Homeland Security Department, said it is worried that voter registration databases and other systems tied to elections could suffer from ransomware attacks before the upcoming 2020 elections. The concern has developed as a result of dozens of ransomware attacks this past year on city and county governments, and they believe that voter registration data could be an attractive target. The agency is working with state officials and private companies to protect election databases and ensure they have a plan to respond to ransomware attacks. The agency has a checklist of things to do to prevent a ransomware attack and to recover from one. They include backing up data and devices that are not connected to the internet, updating and patching software in a timely manner, reviewing security procedures and plans to recover if attacked, and doing drills based on other ransomware attacks. Such efforts are entirely voluntary, however. Democratic leaders are urging Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin to designate cloud services offered by Google, Microsoft, and Amazon as important utilities crucial to financial markets to protect the United States from data breaches. The push comes after a recent breach of Capital One, which uses Amazon Web Services, and was estimated to have impacted 100 million people in the U.S. The designation, if applied to cloud services, would bring enhanced oversight by the Federal Reserve in an effort to protect against catastrophic risk to the nation's financial system. Up next, Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and Senior Vice President at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, Mark Goldwine, will join me to discuss CRFB's recent proposal to combat the next recession. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Mark Goldwine and Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby. Mark is the Senior Vice President and Senior Policy Director for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. He conducts research on a wide variety of topics related to fiscal policy and the federal budget. In 2010, Mark served as Associate Director of the National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility and Reform. In 2011, he was a Senior Budget Analyst on the Joint Select Committee on Deficit Reduction. That same year, he was featured in the Forbes 30 Under 30 list for law and policy. He's also conducted research for the Government Accountability Office, the World Bank, the Historian's Office at the Social Security Administration, and the Institute of Governmental Studies at UC Berkeley. Mark teaches economics at the University of California, D.C., and at Johns Hopkins. Welcome back to Facing the Future, Bob and Mark.
Thanks for having me.
Happy to have you both on the show. Obviously, our listeners are very familiar with Bob, a regular contributor. And Mark, we've had you on the program before. This time, I'd like to discuss a recent plan or proposal that CRFB put out. It's called Break Glass Here, a Responsible Plan to Combat the Next Recession. So I'll start with the very broad question. Why is this report even necessary right now?
All right. So look, right now, the economy, the U.S. economy is still quite strong, or still pretty strong, I should say. Unemployment is low. We're amidst a recovery. Growth is decent. But there are signs that we could be heading into a recession. And the problem with recessions is usually when we get into them, everybody panics. And policymakers just sort of throw baloney at the wall to see what works. What we thought is that instead of waiting until we're in the eye of the recession to figure out how to solve it, that would be helpful if there was some ideas that developed in advance. And given how high our current national debt is, some ideas that were fiscally responsible and didn't make the debt situation even worse.
Given you just said eye of the recession and it's hurricane season, what are some of the trigger points or signs you're referring to that indicate that what we might be heading toward another recession?
So for the most part, it's what we're seeing in financial markets. Things like something called an inverted yield curve, the fact that long-term interest rates are almost as low or even lower than short-term interest rates. That suggests that traders think a recession might be coming. Things like the Federal Reserve reducing interest rates, and they're looking at like a lot of this hard data. They're seeing weakening business investment. So right now, it's sort of these leading indicators. We're not yet seeing it in the real economy. But look, we're in basically the longest recovery in modern history. You can't outrun a recession forever. So maybe there won't be a recession next year. But sometime in, let's say, the next decade, it's very likely we are going to be in recession.
And you mentioned we're in the longest recovery or expansion in modern history. Can you just lay it out for our listeners? What does that mean? How long have we been in recovery? You know, what's the growth rate look like? And you know, if we're going into some kind of contraction, are we looking at negative growth or just really minimal growth? Like, what does all of this mean for the average person?
Right. So remember, about a decade ago, we were in the kind of the heart of the Great Recession. Unemployment rate got up to 10%. We did have some a couple of years of very slow or negative growth. Housing values went down a lot. And then we've been kind of climbing our way out of that. There have been some bursts and there have been some slower climbs, but we've basically been climbing our way out of that recession for the last decade. And especially the last few years, we've been climbing at an accelerated rate. And as a result, unemployment is very low. And I don't want to say that we're in a recession right now. Things in the economy are still doing quite well. But there are just these increasing indicators that the economy may be about to turn.
And I know Bob probably wants to jump in the conversation, but I do have one more question on this before we turn our focus to the proposal you guys put together. Have you mentioned or alluded to the fact that the economy could continue to grow? It could stay on this steady state pace for a little while longer, or maybe even a year longer, or however long. But my question to you is, have recent policy decisions advanced the likelihood of a recession hitting sooner rather than later, or are you of the opinion it's really just part of the natural cycle?
I think that we're certainly not setting ourselves up for success. When you think about the effects of the trade war, the political uncertainty, and then you add to that, we've given the economy a lot of temporary stimulus at a time the economy was strong. I think that we are putting ourselves in a position to make a recession more likely, and that's unfortunate.
Mark, this is Bob. I think a lot of people, I think there's a really good idea of having a plan in place to deal with a recession if it comes. And that would be true whether we are looking for a recession or not. I mean, I always think it's a good thing to be prepared. One of the things that I think a lot of people don't realize is that the federal government has already has automatic stabilizers, they're called, that kick in a recession where spending on certain things like unemployment compensation, other income support mechanisms automatically goes up, and that helps in a recession. You have lower tax collection, so that helps with the on the consumption side. Before we get into the break glass plan that you're talking about, could you briefly discuss the role of automatic stabilizers and why we could actually need something more in times of a recession?
Sure. So the economy really has three tools to fight recessions. It has, as you said, automatic stabilizers, and these are things that go into effect without any legislative action. So, for example, if the unemployment rate goes up, more people will collect unemployment benefits, and those benefits will help to stimulate the economy by encouraging, by giving people money to spend. Their tax rates will go down. Their means tested benefits will go up. So some of this happens automatically. The second tool we have is monetary policy. The Federal Reserve can cut interest rates. And the third tool we have is what we call discretionary stimulus. These are actions taken by Congress. In a shallow recession, in a mild recession, automatic stabilizers and monetary policy are often enough. And we don't want to do additional stimulus just for the purpose of doing stimulus. But interest rates are already quite low, meaning that the Federal Reserve doesn't have much to cut. And that's why I think in the next recession, it's more likely than not that we are going to need some additional stimulus beyond what automatic stabilizers do.
Mark, picking up off of that, you mentioned that the first two automatic stabilizers, the monetary policy and I think it's workers' comp and things like that, would be enough to combat a mild or shallow recession. So with the proposal you're putting forward, are you expecting, based on the leading indicators, that it could be a fairly significant drop in economic growth and an actual sustained recession?
I hope not. What we wanted to do was put forward an illustrative plan based on sort of where we think the policy conversation is going, so they're ready with the offsets. And the size of the plan we picked was frankly relatively arbitrary. It was $600 billion. That's about 3% of 1 year's GDP or 1.5% over 2 years. The actual size of the stimulus we need might be much less. It could be more. We didn't want to get into that in part because we don't really know the economic condition. I mean, if you ask me how much stimulus we want today, the answer is zero. We're already borrowing too much. But economic conditions can change quickly, and our plan is dialable up or down depending on how bad things get.
So the $600 billion figure, was that based off of what we've seen in past recessions in terms of the stimulus necessary to kind of get the economy back up and running again, or is it relatively arbitrary just to put a dollar figure to some of these policies?
It's more arbitrary because every recession is going to be different. Look, last recession, we injected about $2 trillion of total stimulus into the economy. Recessions before that have sometimes been only $100 billion. We didn't think that without knowing what the economy would look like, we could with any certainty say how much money was needed, but we needed a starting point. And we sort of put the policies together and came up with $600 billion. It just is an illustration.
And before we switch over to talking about the specific policies and the proposal you put forward, one thing you did mention was how the Federal Reserve may have limited room because interest rates are already pretty low, or actually very low, when you're talking about the historical nature of this. Why not, you know, encourage the Federal Reserve to go in the negative in terms of interest rates and combating a recession? Is that good or bad economic policy?
Right. So there's this idea that we used to think that the lowest most the Federal Reserve can do to stimulate the economy is cut interest rates to zero. Because if interest rates are less than zero, nobody's going to put their money in a bank. They'd rather put it under their mattress. Now, it turns out, as we've seen from other countries, interest rates can go somewhat negative because people actually see a value in somebody holding their money. But in my mind, that's sort of a difference in magnitude, not in kind. I mean, what we used to think of as a zero lower bound is maybe in a negative 0.3 lower bound. It doesn't fundamentally change the picture.
So it's just an extended range to go a little below zero to help prop up the economy.
Yeah, we might be able to go a little below zero, but it's not as if we could have large negative interest rates because, look, we know we've always known people are willing to pay some for, say, a bank to hold their money. That's why we have ATM fees and all sorts of other fees. It doesn't mean that people are going to be willing to pay a lot. And so I expect that the idea of the zero lower bound is wrong, but it's only off by a little bit, that maybe we have a negative 0.3 lower bound or something like that.
Either way, it would be ideal not to go there. So your proposal has, I think, three primary principles and a couple different frameworks. So give us the broad description of what the plan is trying to do and some of the primary points you'd want to highlight within it.
Sure. So the most important thing we wanted to do in this plan was make sure that there is some ideas out there to pay for stimulus over time. Because what we have to understand is, debt is already the highest it has ever been since World War II. On our current course, we're headed to those World War II levels by 2030. If we have a recession, we're going to get there way earlier. And so we talk about how the Fed doesn't have as much space, but nor does Congress. At the same time, it's impossible to stimulate the economy without adding to the deficit, because that's the way it works, is you give people more money so they can spend, or you buy more things. And so what we wanted was sort of we call it break the glass. We want a plan that's in case of emergencies that can increase the near-term deficit to stimulate the economy, but actually reduce the long-term debt to give us more space for say, the next stimulus. And we came up with a framework that basically assumed a relatively straightforward stimulus bill of four parts: extend unemployment benefits, offer a payroll tax holiday, increase the Medicaid matches the federal government gives to states, and invest in infrastructure. And then we came up with two different options for how you could pay for these costs, so again, they would reduce rather than adding to the long-term debt.
And just picking up on the long-term debt issue there, obviously this is going to result in a short-term boost to annual deficits. Do you have any figures there? So right now we're looking at a $1 trillion deficit as early as the upcoming fiscal year under existing policy. If this proposal is meant to combat a recession in the near term, how much larger could those short-term deficits actually be?
Well, they could get quite large. I mean, if you think about it, this is a $600 billion package. Let's even say it's spread over 3 years, although I think mostly it's spread over 2 years. That means we're talking about a $200 to $300 billion boost on those trillion-dollar deficits. But if we're in a recession, the deficits are going to expand on their own. So we could very well be facing deficits in excess of $1.5 trillion, which is, frankly, not a number I expected to see, and it's something that's quite scary. And that's why it's really important that if we're going to increase the deficit in the near term, we are reducing it over the medium and long term.
I think that's a number deficit that I never expected to see, and I'm still amazed that we're even talking about such numbers. But I think you make a really good point about if we are going to enact short-term stimulus, we can pay for it in the long term. And I think you make the point in this paper that paying for something in the long term can actually enhance the short-term economic growth, because it makes the stimulus more effective, because it's giving markets and businesses and individuals confidence that it's not just heading into the abyss, that there's some plan to right the ship once the recession is over.
That's right. I think paying for stimulus has a few advantages over not paying for it. One is, as you said, it gives us confidence today. And so it makes it less likely that an economic crisis could spill over into a fiscal crisis, you know, which has happened in other countries. Number two, we know that when the economy is strong, lower debt actually encourages and supports more investment, which supports more growth. This is better for long-term growth. And number three, part of the way the stimulus works is by encouraging people to spend today what they otherwise would have spent tomorrow. And if they know, you know, their situation tomorrow is not going to be as generous, it may make it even more likely for them to spend today. And then lastly, it's sort of like, you know, reloading the cannon, because our next recession is not going to be the last recession. And while I do think as a country we can borrow to make it through the next recession, I'm not so sure we can borrow through to make it through the recession after that and the one after that and the one after that. But if every time we're doing this borrowing, we're reloading the cannon and paying it back, it'll allow us to keep fighting these recessions as they occur.
To give people a reminder about how bad the long-term situation is, how serious it is, over the summer, CBO, Congressional Budget Office, came out with a couple of 30-year projections of where we were headed, and debt held by the public ranged in those scenarios anywhere from 144% of GDP to over 200% of GDP. So there is a recession or no recession, there's a long-term problem, and actually the CBO baseline that came out since those long-term projections is considerably worse, so it could be that when CBO updates its long-term projections, they're going to look worse than they did earlier this summer.
We've actually extrapolated out those CBO projections to 75 years. And if you look at the course we're on, you know, debt is headed towards 500 to 600% of the economy within 75 years. There's no historic, there's no international, there's no theoretical precedent or basis to suggest that is sustainable. And so whatever we do now in the short-term economy, if we don't at some point fix that long-term debt, we're in a heap of trouble.
And, Mark, I mean, I think one of the significant things, too, is that CBO considerably ratcheted down its projection of interest rates, meaning that they were assuming it's going to be cheaper to finance all this debt, but it still becomes overwhelming, even if you assume that interest rates stay pretty low.
That's right. CBO is basically assuming interest rates are going to stay almost 2 percentage points below their historic averages. They're going to be extremely low. And if they were just to be 1 point higher, you know, halfway up towards where they've been in recent years, we're talking about another $2 trillion of debt.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Concord Executive Director Bob Bixby and Senior Vice President at CRFB Mark Goldwine. We're discussing CRFB's new plan to combat the next recession, which may be coming sooner than all of us hope, and some of the fiscal policy, long-term fiscal policy implications of dealing with that sort of economic downturn. And you both made really great points about changes in the interest expense and how that can impact deficits and the debt in the long term as well. I wanted to go back to something you said, Mark, before we dive headlong into the proposal. And you mentioned sort of, I guess, I think it was reloading the cannon was the phrase that you used, about how we respond with fiscal policy coming out of a recession. And coming out of the Great Recession, we saw some decline in the annual deficit, in part because of some budget mechanisms or caps, and then also because the economy was growing. But we certainly have swung back the other way now, heading back towards trillion-dollar deficits. So how confident are you that we could actually have, as a nation, a fiscally responsible response to the next recession?
Frankly, I'm not optimistic. Congress has shown, and the president, that when economic times are good, and all theory says you should be reducing the deficit, that we'd rather increase it. I mean, just in the last 2 years, we've increased spending by about $2 trillion over a decade and cut taxes by $2 trillion. It doesn't take a math genius to know that's a problem. So how confident am I Congress will choose responsibility this time? Not that confident. But what we want to do is push them in that direction. And even if they don't adopt the exact illustrative plan we put forward, to push them toward the idea that we cannot keep adding to the deficit year after year with no pay-fors and no consequences.
Mark, what about the public perspective on the heels of something like this? Say we go through another recession very soon. We're already at that $1 trillion mark, and as you mentioned, we could be at $1.5 trillion in the short term with budget deficits. How do you think the public would respond to numbers like that? Are they numb at this point? From your perspective, when it comes to these challenges we're facing in the budget, or is there eventually, are you hopeful there's a wake-up call in the near future?
It's hard to say. Historically, I think ironically, the public has most demanded deficit reduction when deficits are really high because of recessions, and that's actually the worst time to do deficit reduction. And I think this plan offers a way out to some degree because it says, okay, we'll do the deficit reduction now, but it won't phase in until the economy's recovered, when it can actually be helpful. So I'm hoping that we can kind of leverage public opinion here to push toward what would be good economic policy. But it's hard to know how much is too much, and when the public is going to say enough is enough, we need to get these deficits and debt under control.
Just procedurally, are you envisioning something would be enacted, but it wouldn't go into effect, or that they would agree on a plan, and then they would bring it up as a piece of legislation if... you know, the economy had one or more quarters of negative growth?
Yeah, great question. So I think this could work either way. A lot of elements of this Break the Glass plan actually are really just strengthening automatic stabilizers. So, for example, right now the federal government pays about, let's say, 60% of Medicaid costs per typical state, but it varies based on the state's structural economic conditions. What we say in our plan is, let's have that vary based on also the state's cyclical economic conditions. So if one state goes into a recession, they're going to have a stronger Medicaid match. But if one state has an economic boom, they're actually going to contribute more to their Medicaid. And so we could enact that today. It would actually would be deficit reducing so long as the economy is strong, and it would be deficit increasing when the economy is weak. I think those are the ideal types of policies, the one that we don't have politicians just fighting over how to do giveaways for everything that sounds good but has nothing to do with the economy.
I remember when we were plunged into the last recession and Congress was thinking about ways to do this and the administration was trying to react, we used to talk about that it had to be targeted, timely, and temporary. Targeted in that you can throw money at a problem, but if it's not going at the right place, it's not really stimulus. Timely, and timely is one of the most difficult things in one of these things, because you're never really sure whether you're acting too early or too late. And temporary is a point that you've been talking about, that it should phase out after a while, because otherwise you just run up debt. Do you think that those three targets or those three premises are reflected in this plan?
Yeah, I think so. So look, we didn't have a clever alliteration like timely, targeted, and temporary, but we did put forward three principles for stimulus that I think match. The first is they need to be focused on policies that actually have high return. That's sort of that targeted. This isn't about giving away spending increases and tax cuts to your friends or special interest groups. It's about finding the way to most efficiently spend each dollar to boost the economy. Number two, they need to credibly ramp up as the economy weakens and go away as the economy recovers. Right? That's kind of that temporary and that timely. The stimulus should be there to stimulate. It's not there because it's fun, right? It's not there because why not? It's there when the economy needs it. And number three, and this one is really important, we think, we need to offset near-term deficit increases with gradual long-term deficit reduction, because the debt is already too high and we cannot keep adding to it on a sustained basis.
I actually have three questions for those three principles. The first one, I think the phrase used in the proposal was bang for your buck policies. I know you've talked about some of the policy changes you would make. Which ones fall into the bang for your buck category? Are there others that we haven't talked about yet?
Yeah, so unemployment benefits is a great example of bang for buck. You're giving cash to people that basically otherwise don't have cash. They will spend the whole thing. Infrastructure can be a good bang for buck over the medium term. If you have a really short recession, infrastructure isn't the wisest, because by the time you get the permits done, the recession will be out of recession. But for a longer recession, infrastructure can be really helpful, because it's direct spending by the government. And it has the advantage that at the end of the day, you have a bridge or a road or new green energy or out of it, right? So even if it doesn't stimulate the economy, it can still help the long term. A payroll tax holiday, which we put in here, is sort of medium for bang for buck. It has the advantage of being simple and straightforward, and people understand it. There's no sort of special interest politics. It's not the most targeted type of tax cut, but it's decently well targeted to meet the needs. And so that's where we started. But there's, you know, other people have talked about expanding food stamps. I think that's an interesting idea, or sending people rebate checks, even sending people maybe debit cards that expire so they have to spend the money soon. I think there's lots of great ideas out there.
And I want to get a little bit of clarification on the ramping up stimulus in a credible way. Is credibly ramping up stimulus just a nod to we should eventually pay for these things, or does it have some other meaning?
When we talk about credibility, I think the credibility here is everybody should view these policies as temporary and stimulative. So, for example, in the 2009 stimulus, we included a bunch of measures that were actually separately proposed as permanent policy. And so people thought, we're never going to let the CITC expansion go away. And guess what? We didn't. We made it permanent. We don't think that makes sense for stimulus. If there's good policy ideas, that's great. Pay for them. If you have a stimulus idea, it should be something that you can tell people credibly is going to go away as the economy recovers.
And then after this question, I'll kick it back over to Bob. I know he had a question follow-up from our earlier portion of the discussion. And that was the point, the principle of offsetting near-term deficit increases with long-term reductions. My question is, are you afraid that this is just going to lead to more of the same? And this sort of goes back to the political reality we were talking about earlier, but most budget proposals now, most reform packages now are front-loaded with expensive ideas and back-loaded with basically what amounts to gimmicks because they're never actually going to be paid for.
So what we put forward in our plan was very specific illustrative offsets that in most cases would start immediately, but would start so small that they wouldn't have an effect. So the best example is a policy called change CPI. It's a more accurate measure way to measure inflation. It's also slightly slower. It saves about $1 billion in the first year, but it saves $200 billion over 10. The Medicaid, as I mentioned before, is another great example. You change the Medicaid formula immediately so that it does more for states when the economy is weak, and it expects more from states when the economy is strong. I do think that we have a credibility issue. We need to make sure that these offsets are just as credible as the withdrawal of the stimulus.
Mark, you mentioned 2009, the last recession, and it was quite a big one, and Congress was grappling with how to do this. And there was a stimulus package that was enacted. Eventually, there was a payroll tax holiday. There was an infrastructure package. There were extended unemployment compensation benefits. What was your assessment of how that worked relative to what you're proposing now?
Yeah. So I think that in total, we probably had about $2 trillion of stimulus in the last Great Recession. There was that big $800 billion package, but then we had a lot of one-offs. I think overall, it did a decent job, and we did what was necessary. But it was so rushed that we didn't get the design as well as we could, and we didn't worry about the long-term consequences, right? There was such a rush to get that 2009 stimulus that they basically said, hey, everyone, if you have an idea that costs money, pile it on here. And some of those ideas also happen to be very stimulative. And others of those ideas didn't stimulate the economy at all. Like, we used the stimulus as an opportunity to update our health IT. That's a great idea, but it had no stimulative effect on the economy. So I think it was a mixed bag, but overall, it was necessary given the size of the Great Recession. This time we have the luxury of time because we're not in a recession right now. The economy, as I said, is still strong, and we should use that luxury of time to design a better package and to make sure that doesn't increase the debt. Remember, in 2009, debt basically doubled over the Great Recession from 35 to 70% of GDP. We couldn't do that again. We just couldn't afford it.
But to me, this package really does look like it takes advantage of the lessons learned from the last recession and puts it together in a way that makes a lot of sense.
And Mark, looking a little more closely at the proposal, you have, I think, what amounts to two frameworks or a base plan, modest offsets to bold offsets. Can you break that down a little bit for us? Does that mean, you know, you have the base stimulus package with a modest offset, but if you want to go further, do the base package and beyond, or are they two separate frameworks?
Yeah, so we basically offer two separate frameworks. A framework that really is focused on just paying for the stimulus, and a second framework that's focused on using the stimulus as a way to actually make significant improvements in the long term. So the version that we call the modest offset, basically it says we're going to extend unemployment benefits, we're going to pay for it by making some adjustments to the unemployment tax. We're going to offer a temporary reduction in the Social Security payroll tax, we're going to pay for that by using a more accurate measure of inflation for Social Security benefits. We're going to increase the amount we spend on Medicaid, we're going to pay for that by preventing states from inflating their match in the future. And we're going to invest in infrastructure today, we're going to pay for that by bringing forward some projects we would have been doing tomorrow and also by increasing the gas tax. That's the modest offset plan. The bold offset plan says, hey, while we're doing the stimulus, let's actually also fix some structural issues. So while we're offering a one-time payroll tax holiday, let's make Social Security permanently sustainably solvent so that it's not going to just run out of reserves in 15 years. While we're giving states more money in Medicaid, let's totally change the formula we use to better formula for Medicaid matches. And while we're investing in infrastructure in the near term, let's phase in a carbon tax so we can actually deal with the very real threat of climate change over the medium and long term.
And I have just one more question before we have to let you go, Mark, and that is looking at this plan, broadly speaking, you have, it seems like, policies that are popular on either side of the aisle, but do you see this as a potentially bipartisan package that could be actionable, not just if we're forced into it, but it has attractive ideas for both Republicans and Democrats?
I see what we put forward as a bipartisan framework. I don't think that anyone in Congress is going to literally take this paper and put in a legislative language. But what I hope is that they're going to take the themes from this paper and the ideas from this paper and use it to design their own packages. And this should be an issue that both Republicans and Democrats care about. Neither Republicans nor Democrats should want a weakened near-term economy, and neither Republicans nor Democrats should want to be burdened with ever-rising levels of debt over the long run. So I do think there's room for bipartisanship here, and frankly, there's a need for bipartisanship as well.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me, Bob Bixby, and Senior Vice President at CRFB, Mark Goldwine. We discuss CRFB's new plan to combat the next recession. Thank you both for joining the show once again.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
We'll be back after these short messages with our final segment, Facing the Facts. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and this is our final segment, Facing the Facts, where I share with you a fact or a piece of information that I think is worth you pondering until next week's show. So, it's time to face this fact. Popular options like cutting waste, fraud, and abuse, or growing our way out of debt, are not enough to address the nation's fiscal challenges. Many politicians who want to simultaneously receive credit for promoting fiscal responsibility while avoiding the tough decisions required, often look for easy solutions. The two most commonly proposed solutions are, one, pledges to cut waste, fraud, and abuse, and two, to grow our way out of the problem. These supposedly easy options, however, are not enough to address our nation's long-term fiscal challenges. Not to mention, in practicality, they're not actually that easy. There is no line item in the budget labeled, quote, waste, fraud, and abuse. Even if such a category did exist, there would be strong disagreements about what it should include. Spending that some call waste may seem to others like valuable government services. And while improving efficiency and combating fraud would be helpful and could save money, it would not be a sufficient strategy for fixing the nation's long-term fiscal challenges. The Government Accountability Office regularly identifies opportunities for consolidating duplicative programs and improving inefficient ones, but the savings total in the tens of billions of dollars. I say but because it's a relatively small sum compared to the more than $12 trillion in deficits
projected over the next decade. Don't get me wrong, billions of dollars is a lot of money. But by the end of the decade, nearly all discretionary spending, not just the identifiable waste, fraud, and abuse, would need to be eliminated entirely to close the government's annual shortfalls. In addition, even substantial savings from cutting waste, fraud, and abuse would mostly provide one-time gains that would not alter the basic structural nature of our projected deficits, meaning that drop in the bucket won't change the long-term trajectory of our growing deficits. Social Security, often the third rail of politics, actually provides a prime example of the challenges such a strategy faces when it comes to reducing mandatory spending programs. An analysis by the Social Security Administration estimated a total of improper payments in fiscal year 2015 of approximately $5 billion. A portion of them were actually underpayments. Total improper payments represented just over half of 1% of the entire program. Even eliminating all of them would not come close to closing the program's total funding gap. As for growing our way out of the debt problem, some politicians claim that their policies would unleash economic growth of 4, 5, or even 6% each year. Such growth would allow the federal government to run substantially higher deficits without increasing the nation's debt-to-GDP ratio. There is, however, no evidence to suggest that such growth could be sustained, and only slight evidence it would be possible even for a very short period of time, as we've seen by the quick jolt generated by the recent tax cuts that's already starting to wear off. Only once in the past three decades has GDP grown at 5%. The 30-year average GDP growth rate has been a far more modest 2.6% per year. And the challenge will be even more difficult going forward due to demographic changes. Since 1950, the growth in potential GDP, the maximum possible production of the economy if all resources were fully utilized, has been due in roughly equal parts to a growing labor force and rising productivity. Over the next decade, the Congressional Budget Office projects productivity growth at slightly below what the average has been since 1950. The outlook for labor force growth, however, is far worse, just one-third of the recent historical average. This means it will be challenging to just maintain the growth rates of the past few decades, let alone to achieve levels unprecedented in recent history. For example, the CBO and other credible organizations now project average economic growth at 2% or less in the coming decade. There are simply no easy solutions for our long-term fiscal challenges. Federal policymakers will instead need to confront difficult trade-offs on taxes and popular spending programs. In essence, they're going to have to start making the tough choices. You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.